It's the Lean Into Artcast, the show where cartoonists and teaching artists wander around a visual storytelling topic and try to find their way back. But even if we don't make it back, it's fun to wander, right? So let's lean into it. So, Rob.
Yeah, Jersey.
I was talking with Sharon Iverson at the Ann Arbor District Library about your upcoming appearance in January for the Comic Artists Forum, where you're going to be doing a Skype talk for us.
Yeah.
And she was wondering, in February, so January, we're going to have you do a talk about making comics. I guess if we've said where you live before, you're out of Minnesota.
Oh, yeah.
And Minnesota, January, doing a talk over Skype. February, we're going to have Scott Yoshinaga and Audra Furuichi of Nemu Nemu there in Hawaii. In February, we both know, being Midwesterners, what February weather is like, right?
Mm-hmm.
What in our neck of the woods, it's, you know, people start eating each other because they can't get out of their houses because it's buried in snow.
Yeah, your keys will freeze to your hands if you're not careful. Things like
that. I remember one winter where with the wind chill, it was reported, I didn't measure it, but it was reported that it was 70 below with the wind chill Fahrenheit. I don't know, it was maybe like 10 or 20 below regularly, but with the strong winds that we get across the Midwest, especially with the Great Lakes in Michigan, all that lake effect weather. And I remember getting into my car. I was working late shift at the casino, and I was scraping my car and everything, scraping all the snow off as we have to do. Got in the car, turned it over. And when it's that cold, it's like, wow, 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 brrr, right? And then as soon as the air came on, all of the moisture on my hands from scraping my windshield, like, just instantly turned to steam from my body heat. So I was like moving. I looked like a guy who was tripping on something. So I was like moving my hands from my face going, whoa, because I was moving my hand. There's smoke coming off my hands. But it's just because the temperature difference was so extreme because the air was so dry and so crisp and so cold. So anyway, that was, I don't even know what that was. That was not even a tangent.
It must be what it's like kind of as far as like walking on the moon or something. It's not quite, it's a little colder on the moon, but
yeah,
you know, you're approaching that level of desolation.
Yeah. Well, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, like, yeah, it's like you get an entirely different landscape when that weather hits. I mean, the landscape literally changes. But anyway, so Sharon was asking, she said, wow, we got a Minnesotan for January, Hawaii residents in February. I wonder if we can get them, when they do the Skype chat, to be in front of a window so we can see the environment behind them and we can see the cold, frosty desolation behind you in January. And then in February, it's like, oh, tropical plants and volcanoes.
Like shine in the background in Hawaii.
People just leaping and hugging and surfboarding. Yeah, that's all that will be happening behind them. And we're just all miserable and bundled up like Ralphie's little brother in A Christmas Story.
Cool. I'll do that. You guys, that's a fantastic idea.
The deal?
Yep.
Okay. I'll try to talk to Scott and Audra about it. They're at nemu-nemu.com, by the way. Give them web credit before we give ourselves web credit. I'll tell you what. Here's my curveball today. I'm still reeling from yesterday's recording of Comics Are Great, episode 29, which is not available to download yet. It will be soon. If you're listening to this way after the fact, it's at comicsaregreat.com/CAG29. You were participating on that one in the chat.
Yeah, I was there for most of it.
And I think the big idea that I walked away with, that I was really kind of stunned by, was a repackaging of the idea that social media for content creators is different than people who just use social media. Like my brother, who works for a motor company, he's not a public figure, right? He's like a normal person. And so when I watch him engage on Facebook, it's like, hey, what about the Lakers? You know, here's a picture of my daughter. But there's something inherently public about being a content creator, a author, or any kind of, like, you know, a person who creates content to be consumed by the public, some kind of entertainment or educational or whatever. There's an implicit suggestion, at least this is what Eli's sort of assertion was, is that there's an implicit suggestion that we are public figures and the rules change for us when we do that. And so his suggestion, I'm paraphrasing an opinion of one man. So this is where these ideas get, like, what everything I'm saying right now is like potentially extremely muddy.
Game of telephone.
Yeah. Danny's purple. The idea mutates into something unrecognizable. But what I wanted to throw at you was Eli's assertion that if you want to be, you know, share privately, make a private account for whatever you're using and then have your public account. And then he said the number one rule is be interesting. Don't do the whole I'm sitting in a beanbag, I'm eating chips, the chips are gone, I'm moving on to something else. There's something that has to be inherently entertaining or interesting in everything you share because it's another layer of content in your thing. Now, I tried to back out and say, well, what do we mean by interesting, right? Because interesting can mean being funny. You look at Weird Al Yankovic and watch his Twitter feed. He's posting, it's mostly funny pictures that he posts, right? Like he found a bank that was called Tomato Bank. And he took a picture of himself holding a big pile of tomatoes looking sad in front of the bank, said Tomato Bank. And then his caption was, oh, darn it, they're always closed by the time I get there. You know, things like that. But then, you know, does it have to be pure entertainment? Can it be an interesting thought? Something that I've gotten yelled at before on Twitter. People said, like, I'm unfollowing you for this. Is when I try to get a discussion started. I'm like, here's an idea that I read about in an article. I think it's really fascinating. What do you guys think? And then people start responding to my thoughts and I'll start retweeting their thoughts because I want to get a conversation going. And then people say, quit clogging up my feed. So maybe that's the wrong way to do it. Or I'm guessing, my prediction is as I turn it over to Rob, the Zen master sitting over there with a candle in front of him, that there is no right or wrong way. But what I'm still struggling with is trying to define the word interesting in sharing content. Zing!
Well,
take it away.
Absolutely. What's funny is I don't know. We could fashion a puppet of me, and I think you could. You more or less you nailed it as far as what I would think, right? But it's. It is very much subjective and it's individual. And I think it's super legitimate for someone who likes to sit in a beanbag after they make comics or while they lament about the possibility of when they go about making comics, whatever their style is, and they share their style, that's part of their content. People who choose to do that. And what's, I think you could find examples of that where people are very good at just communicating those basic day-to-day things. And they happen to be an artist of a comic that you'd follow. And depending on your interest, well, think about things like TMZ, something that I don't consume, but I know friends who do, right? Mm-hmm. Seriously.
Me too. I have friends who think TMZ is absolutely fascinating in a strange, morbid way, right? Yeah, or they watch like Keeping Up with the Kardashians or... You know, Hogan Knows Best, Gene Simmons Family Jewels, watching people walk around and try to do their laundry.
Sure. The Osbournes being an older example too. Yeah. Where, so there's the reality aspect and sharing your experience. So you're going to do that when you're trying to do useful stuff. You're going to do that when you're telling stories, you want to draw people's attention to it. Or you could do that just by saying, I ate a sandwich and I found a chicken bone in it, I guess. Yeah. You know, if that's a possibility for you, but, and your audience could think that any of those three different possibilities is either awesome or horrible. And, that's all right. I mean, I guess it's about the act of, cultivating your audience. And do you care about that? Being one, you could just ignore any of the feedback and, or you could choose to fine tune what you're providing based on that.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing that I think
that's
was
not meant to be a bad answer. I mean, that's like a whole lot of like these are all building blocks that could fit together in any way, shape, or form, or get chucked.
Are you saying that you're speaking abstractly?
Yes.
No, the other thing that Eli said that I was really grateful for is that after all that talk, he said, like, well, you know, don't change your message or your style to satisfy those six people who yell at you, right? And I think that's really good advice that we need to be reminded of all the time, is that there's going to be people who just are mad about something. And I'm not trying to diminish anybody's legitimate complaints about anything, but there's going to be people who are mad, and you can't change what you do just to satisfy that, because you got to, we probably talked about this before, I'm thinking, but
I think a little bit, but not so directly, because there's so many layers to it, because you have what you're putting out there, and are you trying to fine tune it for the audience or not? And then if you are in that mode of fine tuning, chances are you're going to be responding and adjusting based on what the audience is saying back. But even then, it's not precise, because if you're going to fine tune what you're sharing so you're an entertainer if you're providing comics, or you're an educator if you're providing comics and how to make comics and whatnot, or illustration service and consult, whatever you're doing as far as why you're reaching out and connecting to through that social medium, it's still a wide open as far as how you want to, I guess it's worth to reinforce things we've talked about before. I think it's worth thinking about and doing on purpose. Reflect on it. Where do you want to go with it?
Yeah. That word interesting is like such a slippery eel, you know? It's like, be interesting. What does that mean? You know? That's it's an interesting demand to put on ourselves. I used the word interesting to describe the subject of being interesting. But it's a fascinating idea to think about being intentionally, always being on. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say. It's like, maybe instead of saying be interesting, is that always be on when you're engaging with your audience. And this I don't think is artificial. I do not think it's artificial, because I've talked about this before on one of the different podcasts I've done, is the idea that when I'm teaching a class, like a physical class, right? I'm walking into a room full of kids and teach them about comics. No matter how rotten I feel, if I got in a fight with my wife, if I am running on 4 hours of sleep, or, you know, I'm worried about bills or whatever, and I'm dragging my feet to that door, the moment I cross that threshold, I'm somebody else. I'm like, hey, all right, we're going to talk about comics. Here's the assignment today. We're going to talk about these things. Here's some key concepts. And I turn on like a performer does, because a stand-up comedian doesn't get to walk out on stage and go, look, guys, I was up way too late last night, and I should not have had that bottle of tequila. So I'm going to be a little quiet today. You don't get to do that, you know? But at the same time, that performance, and maybe stand-up comedy is a bad example, because I got another curveball I could pitch at you if I wanted to, is that I'm being sincere in my classrooms, right? When I'm putting on my game face or turning myself on for this class or workshop, it's because I care about this and I'm being sincere about everything I say. It's just that I'm not letting these people in on the background stuff, because it's outside of the scope of that environment, right? Whereas with a performer, I was just watching a stand-up comedian, Daniel Tosh. Have you ever watched that guy?
I came across the name recently, but no.
Very acidic humor. Okay. Very harsh. It's like I would say George Carlin meets Don Rickles, but even meaner. And at times it could be very funny. I mean, I'm not making a judgment when I say he's mean. I mean, he commands a very large audience. So, I mean, something in there, what he's doing is people are responding to. And I mean, it also goes to the idea about humor essentially being an aggressive act. Like, you're pointing out something that you find is foolish or absurd, and you're calling it out, right? Yeah, but his stuff is very...
It is likely territory where someone's frustrated, and they're trying to deal with that frustration through humor.
Right. And so, but he'll go and say things like, you know, if I'm dating you and you gain 30 pounds, I'm going to break up with you because I'm that shallow, you know? And like, that's kind of like the humor that's an example of the kind of humor he has. And I know I'm not representing him perfectly, but you know, you can find his stuff everywhere, and make your own judgment on that. But what it spawned was a conversation between me and my wife where we were like, I wonder how much of that is really him and how much of that is the performance, right? is this him? Is this Larry the Cable Guy, where it's like he's not really that guy? He's just putting on a completely different persona? Or do these jokes come out of some kind of truth in this guy's character, where maybe he is like a little bit of a jerk like that? But, you know, then I think of George Carlin, who, let's face it, George Carlin, his comedy is legendary. It was very thoughtful and intellectual, but also incredibly filthy and rebellious, right? But then he was on Shining Time Station, right? So, you know, the George Carlin persona you saw couldn't be the entire guy, because he also did children's shows. I mean, if he was truly that character that walked on stage and said all those filthy things, and somebody said, "Hey, you want to do Shining Time Station?" He'd be like, "No, F you, get the F out of my face, because I'm not going to do that sloppy kid stuff," right?
But to the same extent that would you say that you're not the enthusiastic, energetic, creative instructor that you are because you have a hard day at the grocery store, or you know, a tough time working at some home repairs that sort of tap into maybe more of your primal feelings?
Yeah.
I mean, does that make one or the other not genuine?
Right. No, good point. Good point. Yeah. I was going down, walking down the stairs to the studio, and one of my cats got in my way, and I almost fell down the stairs, and it's concrete floor at the bottom. It's a dangerous thing. Out of frustration, I said, like, you know, I don't think I used a swear, but I think I yelled at the cat, like, "Why are you always doing this to me?" You know? It was just a screech of primal frustration. Like, why? It's like, you're trying to kill me. You're trying to kill me. I know you are. And Anne said that she was surprised. She was really taken aback at how angry I was at that cat for just sitting there and just being a cat, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah. I mean, that's genuinely me.
Yeah.
The pink faced guy who's dancing around a room going, "I love comics," is also genuinely me. Yeah. So, okay, there we go. Now we're talking about being interesting in your social media layer of your content, and the difference between a public and private account too, right? Is like being that performer.
This really reminds me of I don't know. I'm sure it's far more refined and detailed than this, but it's my understanding that there's two primary schools of thought that look at the arts. There's those that see them as purely an act of expression, and that is what's genuine. And the act of expressing being something that is not something that has the thought or has an illusion of, you know, artists are just, you know, crazy, wacky, but very skilled people that just randomly make neat stuff. But and then I don't know. Wow, I bet I could really frustrate people with that as the definition of what how they would view the arts. But then there's those that are like, well, we make arts. So the thing, we make arts for our use, to express our ideas, to hold my coffee or my cereal and make my house look nice or whatever. So there you have the crafts and the art as a business aspect. So, and then they're often at odds. And to me, like this conversation reminds me of that quite a bit, where there's the what's interesting, and what's also what is maybe what I'm inferring from the what's interesting question is well, what is real? What's really that person?
Yeah. Yeah.
So in the act of trying to be interesting, does that mean you have to be not fully genuine? Is that part of?
I think that's what a lot of people have problems with. Is that I think a lot of people feel a resistance to a persona as being somehow manufactured and, you know, synthetic. But I think what's helped me in navigating these waters is having been working in classrooms for the past 5 years or 6 years now. Mm-hmm. It's taught me the difference between, you know, being a genuine performer and being a genuine human being. You know, I think the game face term applies to this. You know, put on your game face. This is still me, but it's me in this mode. It's operating in a mode. Maybe that'd be a way to put it to some people to make them understand the difference.
Operating in a mode. So would you, like, what would drive a person to choose a mode? Does it depend on what you're doing, or does it depend on who you're doing that for?
Both, I think. I mean, and back and forth, right? I mean, it's like who you're with. I mean, this is like, let's talk about Google Plus for a second. This is the thing that got me so excited about it, is that it was a technology that actually mimicked how in real life, when I'm around my dad, I talk one way. And when I'm at school, I talk another way. And when I'm with my wife driving her to work, we talk an entirely different way, you know? And those are all really me, like you talked about earlier. It reminds me of, gosh, conversations that have been going around and around lately about how the internet has kind of, like, interacting on the internet has conditioned some people to think that there needs to be a holistic, consistent you that operates the same way in every circumstance. And if you ever contradict yourself or act differently in a certain situation, then somehow you're in error. Right? Wrong. That doesn't follow with the definition cardboard cutout of Jersey that I know. And whereas then I think of that, was it Ben Franklin who said, like, I reserve the right to change my mind at any moment, you know?
Yeah, that is a cool quote, but I'm not quite.
I don't know who said that. It was Shakespeare.
Reserve the right to learn or something like that. That's how I remember it, essentially. To do something new because I discovered something or it's essentially saying that I can keep adapting.
Yeah.
So this is how.
I don't want to beat this point to the ground. It's still hot on my mind, and I was trying to get more discussion going on Google Plus about it. And I knew that you would have some thoughts on the issue, on the act of being interesting while still being genuine. And knowing how to do that. And I think thinking about it as a performance, thinking about it as a switching into a mode, thinking about it the way that how you operate differently in different groups of people is probably a good rule of thumb to help massage the idea into your brain so you don't feel like you're being phony. Nobody wants to I would guess that 99% of people don't want to feel like they're being phony, right?
I would guess as much. Yeah, it's
Or be perceived that they're being phony. Although that's going to happen. That's going to happen no matter what.
Yeah, that's out of your control.
Yeah. So, anyway, you're doing 24-hour comic day in a day or so?
Yeah. Saturday. Cool. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. I'll be at the Minneapolis Center for Book Arts. They're actually hosting an event. And, yeah.
Are you going to be taking any pictures, doing any audio?
I'll experiment with trying to share the experience. It's definitely a show up. I don't know how to say it. It's just kind of my way that you can do this any way you want. And you see people that sharpen their pencils for quite a long time, or some people get straight to it, or some people will. Everyone's got their own way. Like for me, I show up and I get into it like heavy. I said, I'm not preparing a story ahead of time. I'm not preparing anything other than I do plan on using characters I'm familiar with drawing. And I plan on using, I'm thinking about the tools that I'm going to use as well, but not actually the story.
Right.
Or the, yeah.
That's part of the idea behind the 24-hour comic too, is that it's about discovering the story as you go, and which is supposed to also teach you something about, like, looking at building a comic in a whole new way through the desperation of trying to get to that deadline, right? I understand that's part of the mission of the thing, or what some people point out as a value of the thing, right?
It is for me. It's definitely an exercise in finishing, which that's one of my favorite reasons to choose any art challenge. It's to practice finishing, but then to throw some other spin at it, some twist. To practice finishing, but also to learn whatever, something else.
I just would love to see you share a whole bunch from this thing. I mean, if you have time or the presence of mind, I think that'd be super fun to check in on you every once in a while. Because I know maybe streaming the whole thing is out of the question, but hosting the occasional Google Hangout or posting a quick little audio thing or 15 seconds of video of here's Rob cracking up. I don't know what I'm gonna do.
No, that sounds fun, actually. I'll add that to my list of challenges to take on. It's actually something I'm not really good at that. I mean, typically when I do some sort of published communication, even if it's a tweet, it's I think about it a fair amount. So those live events take I'm so content to just be somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm just, this is neat. There's so many other artists here working on this or whatever. I'm going to remember this experience. And then, right. I kind of really whiff the whole idea of documenting it well too. But I'll give it a shot.
Not everybody needs to be Ken Burns, you know? I mean, it's just that I just think that this is a layer of, going back to what we were just talking about, right? About how social media is a layer of content. And I think personally that as a cartoonist who gets involved in public events, it is sort of my responsibility to capture a lot of that experience for people who can't have it, right? I think about when I was growing up, and I grew up in a really rural part of Michigan. I mean, there were literally 25 kids in my class. It was like Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There was, I remember there was a problem where a friend of mine couldn't go to homecoming with, I think, almost every girl in the class because he was distantly related to them in some way. I mean, that sounds like a joke, like a Jeff Foxworthy joke, but it's totally not. That was the situation. We were in this very rural farming community. So I didn't have access to stuff like that. I didn't know what was going on in the world except through the TV. So I think about people who are in distant or remote areas. I get emails from people saying that's all well and good what you're doing in Ann Arbor, but man, I'm wherever, I'm in Montana. There's no community like that here. So it for me, I feel like a slight responsibility to capture these things to let other people be a part of it in some way.
That's really awesome. That's very cool. I can see that being a good thing to have in mind to help, spark the, give me some, reason to do it more. Right. That's a really good idea to reach out to people who really, don't have as easy of a time to join that kind of event. Very interesting.
Or in some cases, it maybe possibly inspire them to try to do it themselves in their area. But also, here's another thing. I mean, beyond all this lofty, inspiring and including, it's also, I think it's interesting to see what other cartoonists are doing. Whenever I see somebody posting video or audio from an event, I'm like, oh, I want to listen in on this. I want to see what was happening there because I wish I could have been there. It's just interesting too. But, it's obviously, if it's something that doesn't occur to you at the time because you're too busy being there and going back to your Zen master thing, right? Then just be there, Don't limit your experience because, oh, I got to capture this. I mean, it's something that comes naturally to me now. Yesterday in class, I'm going to do this on a Fabulous Secrets podcast. I had a kid show up 15 minutes late for class, and I had already been through the whole rigmarole of, this is an old teaching technique, but I was glad that I captured it. I already went through the whole rigmarole of the assignment and explaining the parameters and reasoning behind the assignment. And so this kid gets there, and he's like, so what I miss? And I was like, well, Jenny, why don't you tell him what he missed while I get the paper and pencils ready? And it was a chance for the kid to demonstrate her understanding of what the assignment was while she was also making a connection with this new student because this is the first time these two kids ever met. So now, that's an old teaching trick. But it was the moment she started doing it, and she was doing such a good job. This is a 10 or 11-year-old girl reiterating the concepts that I was teaching. And she did it through analogy, and she was making analogies for the concepts. I grabbed my phone, pulled out my pocket, hit record. And I saw her look at me like, what are you doing? And I'm like, don't worry, I'm not taking your picture enough. And I just want to grab this audio because I might use it in something later on. It was too cool of a moment to not capture.
So. That,
anyway, it's something that comes out from the hip for me. It's just like, grab it now, you know?
Yeah, I look at that as like any habit. Yeah, if it's not an enticing habit to build or grow, I would politely decline and not worry about it. But no, I like that idea. I have found it helpful, and I'm not in a rural area. When I notice when you share things from various events and other folks I follow on Twitter, it's fun to get a, you know, an eye in person, where it's not like being there, but you get to share the experience a bit.
Right.
That's cool.
So, okay. Well, going back to something you said a minute ago, where you were saying about how you don't have a story prepared, and that's part of the idea behind 24-hour comic day.
Mm-hmm.
I had a topic to pitch at you. And I hope this doesn't, stop me if you think this would damage your experience doing 24-hour comic day, because one of the questions that I often get in my classrooms, and one of the things that I find is most difficult to teach, is answering the question, how do you make a story, right? All this stuff about panel size, size relationships, line changes, how color affects our perception. All these things can be taught in some way. Like, if you understand that a big panel means larger moment, more emphatic moment, smaller panel means less emphatic, shorter amount of time, big word balloon means it's loud, etc. We can grasp these concepts, but how do you knit all that together into a story? And all I can ever do is come up with analogies to try to, like, going back to the old concept, and this was a Bruce Lee quote in one of his movies. I forget which movie it was, is that the finger pointing at the moon. You know, I can point at the moon, but if you concentrate on the finger, you miss all the heavenly glories. That was the actual quote from the Bruce Lee film. But I know that it comes from an older text. I forget which one, but or older philosophy. So what I got is, I have an analogy that I wanted to start bouncing back and forth about how to construct a story. And I thought it'd be appropriate to release this right before 24-hour comic day as a, for the guy or gal who's at the art desk panicking, going, where do I go with this thing? Come up with an outline of a mode of thinking or a way of thinking about how to construct a story. Do you think that would damage your experience if you think about this beforehand? Because if it will, I don't want to do it. I want to change tracks and do something else entirely.
No, actually, what I forgot to tell you is that my secret joy is watching other artists suffer. So I can't tell you. No, I'm happy to share whatever I could, you know, if it would be of help to others as far as making a story. So where would you like to go with that then?
Okay, well, I have an analogy here that I wanted to start kicking around. One of the things I always tell people, and especially my adult students, because they have more life experience, is that, first of all, a lot of writing characters is just playing pretend. If you can remember what it was like when you were on the playground as a kid and there's another kid running at you and they're like, hey, I'm Digar. I have shovels for hands. I have a deflector shield. And you announce all your moves because you're imagining a world. You're imagining interactions and it's all happening live. You're responding to their stimulus and their input, and you return with more imagination, right? That's part one. I mean, that's like, okay, you know, kids in a playground, try to remember what that felt like, playing pretend. That's playing characters, except you're playing all of the kids in the playground, right? But the second one that I try to use a lot, and I have a lot of trouble getting headway with this one with certain students, is all writing a story is when you go up to somebody and you say, you're never going to believe what happened to me the other day. That's a story. It's just relaying a series of events with a point. And whenever you say, you're never going to believe what happened to me the other day, you're already starting with the hook. You're starting with the lead or the tease. And you know what the point of your story is. Otherwise, you wouldn't be so excited to tell them that, right? And if you could take one of those personal anecdotes that you share at the office or on the water cooler or around at a family get-together, and if you can break that down, then you've got the essential outline of how to construct a story. And I'm betting you're reading a book on stand-up comedy right now, and I bet this relates to the construction of a joke, like the setup, and then the response, and then the punchline, and that kind of thing.
I think it does, and I'm definitely trying to refine my approach by looking at joke structure and thinking about how jokes are essentially they're a neat thing to analyze, to think about surprise and reveal in stories in general. So I look at that as sort of a refinement where you have your water cooler story, but then you want to bring in these extra, the spice and the moments that hook people to begin with, but then continue to pull them along. And it's one way to do that is through these delightful surprises and curveballs that you can throw your readers, where they will have an expectation that you've set up by by starting your story, but then you play off an assumption that you've planted by giving them that expectation. Yes. And yes, then bring in a surprise from a different angle.
Yep.
And that's embody that magic. And I find them helpful to study for that.
Absolutely. You just explained like the process of telling a good anecdote. The difference between, and this is how I further, sculpt this analogy in my classrooms, is telling an analogy is not, or telling an analogy, telling an anecdote is not going up to somebody, or it can be, but it's usually not very good, going up to somebody saying, these guys, they were on the corner and there was a dog, and then they walked over to the mailbox and they looked in the mailbox and the bus came and the bus didn't pick them up because they missed the bus, and then they had to walk and then they got to work, right? You know, think of like Kids in the Hall, Bruce McCullough's character, Gavin, these guys smoke, that is not an interesting anecdote. That's a relaying of a sequence of events without any context, without any meaning, without any reason that the recipient should care why this is going on. So you got to get them hooked. You got to get them involved. And so you set up expectations. So there I was, and I thought this was happening. And then this worst thing happened. And oh my gosh, I really, like, I just told a story in Mixed Company recently where I was holding my hand like this the whole time as I was talking about, and I was like showing them my morale. Like, oh, I thought this was happening, and then this happened. And then all of a sudden this happened, and I felt really good, and then all of a sudden it went even worse. But even though it ends on a bad note, I walked away with this, mm-hmm. and I came out here, I charted it. I charted it for them as I was telling them the story. Isn't that awful?
No, that's funny. That's totally you added a meta element to the real world there. You know, it's like the points in Scott Pilgrim when people get punched or whatever. And
oh yeah. Okay. Well, nice. But anyway, I wound up, when I told the story, my audience seemed receptive. Maybe they're being polite. I don't know, but they seem to genuinely laugh at something. And at one point, when I described the part where the morale went way down, one of the guys actually exclaimed, like, "Oh, Jesus!" Like that. So,
empathized, and
yeah, I had his empathy. I had him involved in what was happening in my anecdote. So then, when I got to the point when it went way up high, he was like, "Oh, cool! Something really great's gonna happen." And then it got worse. And this really happened. This thing that I'm referring to, as anything in life happens, right? Like lots of things in life happen where you think it's going to be one way and it turns out another. And learning how to pace those things and to describe those things in such a way as to elicit empathy or to get people to set an expectation like, oh, I know where this is going. Oh, right. That's really tricky stuff. And that's stuff where it's kind of like, it's like when you're making food without a recipe, you're just tasting it. Is there enough salt in there? No, I need more salt.
What a surprise. Right, you got to cook that way all the time. Pretty much.
What's that?
Would it surprise you that that's how I typically cook?
Like you actually like pinch with your fingers. You don't actually break out the measuring spoons.
Almost. Yeah. It's all by feel.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Those refinements, this is the, I don't know what you call it. It's my perspective. And we all have our quirks when we create things or whatever. I don't want to, assume everyone does this, but it's super exciting as you're working on practicing some aspect of your craft, and then you discover that next skill, and then that becomes the definition of finishing something, possibly, or it adjusts what you thought you were building toward. And this is where 24-hour comic day would come in and say, I'm 24-hour comic day. I don't care about all these. I don't care about your joke structure. I don't care about your pacing. I don't really care about how detailed your crowd scenes are. I care about it being 24 pages in 24 hours. See you at the end. And there you go.
Go ahead. No, finish your thought. I'm sorry.
No, I think it's a way to flavor and spice your meal of 24-hour comic day to add a pinch of more interesting anecdote by using personal perspective instead of being objectively describing people you don't know. I mean, throw yourself in the scene, all that kind of stuff, and then adding twists and surprises and expectation and setup. But don't get lost in those details without having an eye on the clock.
Sure. To make another analogy on top of all these analogies, is we're describing swimming technique when you're in a pool in a controlled environment. 24-hour comic day is, it's a windy day, surf's up. We're going to drop you in about, half a mile from the shore. See you at the shore. you're fighting those waves going, hey, but I got to remember my technique. I got to remember the proper stroke method. No, not at this point. Now it's just try not to drown. You know, that's really what we're describing here. But should you suddenly get caught in a riptide and, I got to get out of here, that's the time to remember some survival skills, and that's all I'm trying to do here.
Yes, exactly. It's and that's one of the reasons to jump into this is to experience that that adaptation. You'll find out what's coming natural to you that day and jump in. And there's good. And what's funny is depending on how you choose to go about it. If you're alone and just streaming on the internet or calling a friend once in a while, like I guess back when 24-hour comic day was started, it would be Scott McCloud and I cannot remember his buddy that they would just talk on the phone.
And, was it Rick Veitch?
Okay.
Rick Veitch. Is that his name? That's how you pronounce it? V-E-I-T-C-H. Learning German has forever ruined my EI combinations. I can never remember how it is in English versus how it is in German. I think that's who it was. Or Steve Bissett, one of the two.
Could have been. They would just talk on the phone sometimes or whatever. But no matter what your environment is and your social arrangement or non-social, you're going to face things. that's part of the challenge. So you'll bring in whatever you can. Sorry, I got distracted, a little knock at the door or whatever there.
No. I thought that came across as like a thoughtful moment.
Wondering if I should ignore the door. And the answer is
you want to go get the door?
No.
You can go get the door if you need to. I mean, if you're expecting something. What if there's a gas leak? Please edit this.
No problem. There's no gas leak.
All right. Now I'm going to be stressed out on your behalf. You've got a 24-hour comic in the video here we could talk about.
This is from last year's 24-hour comic day. What would you like to delve into about it?
Well, I mean, did you start this thing with a... Okay, you don't start with a story in mind. You said you start with characters that you know how to write. But I'm curious, I didn't do I've never done a 24-hour comic, but I did do that 8-page finished mini comic in a week, that Boulder and Fleet. Now, 8 pages in a week, not a big deal, but it was on top of all my other work, my teaching work, my freelancing work, et cetera. So it was an accomplishment. Just trust me on this, everybody. But one of the challenges I set to myself is I said, I don't know what the story is going to be. I cannot use characters I've ever done before. I cannot do a story that I've had prepared because I got lots of stories and notes that I could just pull out if I need to. But so when facing the blank page, one of the ways that I got into doing that story was I said, well, what's a topic or theme or point that I feel really passionate about, but I don't feel comfortable expressing it publicly? I don't want to, like, the story in the first issue of Boulder and Fleet was based on a conversation that I overheard between some artists, and it really ticked me off. I couldn't disagree with those people more about what they were saying. But instead of going online and saying, those people are idiots, don't listen to them, I disagree with them, I decided to take that passion and let's put it poetically into a story. Let's express my opinion on this matter through characters so that I make an entertaining story and I get to get this out of my system without actually attacking anybody. Do you do that? Do you start with that? Do you ever start with like, okay, here's a bucket of bees in my bonnets that I could possibly throw into this thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think being guided by something that is, something on your mind that you want to communicate, something that's frustrating you. I mean, it's a good place to start. Something that is inspiring you, or what have you. So for you, it was just the structure of the story is what really brought you to it?
No, it wasn't even the structure. It was that, okay, here's the argument that I'm going to investigate through this story. I didn't have a structure. I had essentially an idea about, like, I came up with, like, okay, these characters are going to go here and they're going to encounter this. And my argument is going to be expressed through the heroes. The villains are going to express the opposing argument, the thing I heard those people say that I totally disagreed with. Right. And that was just, it was more or less of an inroad to come up with, let's get the ball rolling. Let's instigate something here. And hopefully use that as a framing mechanism to find my story beats. Because then if I start heading in a direction where, well, maybe they do this next, does that refer to what my argument is? No, doesn't need to happen. It's a way to like do some on-the-fly editing while I'm building something really fast. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And you reminded me of how telling a shorter story can be actually really hard as an exercise also. Yeah. Getting that kind of complete thought in 8 pages is...
Yeah, that I don't know if I did it anyway. I'm not going to profess that I did a wonderful job of it, but I felt satisfied with the book. So we're looking at yours. I mean, so I was just trying to get at, like, did you start with...
Pull up Boulder and Fleet 2 while we were talking. Since we're on video podcast, I mean, right now we have this example, but...
Let's talk about this example then. We can talk about Boulder and Fleet later.
No, okay, cool. So let's see. To share how I started and how in general I start when I go to write, I start by the writing and thumbnailing, and I go back and forth. And what guides me is thinking about a change just from point A to point B. Like the story starts out with a certain idea and then it will end with the twist on that idea. And then what I try to do in the middle is add more waypoints between point A and point B. So how do they get from, and so with this, I sat down and thought, one of the things that helps focus me is I'll think about something I want to improve at. And I thought, I want to tell a story with Pick and Crunchy, two characters I love. But I want to focus on something totally different than I would normally tell in the main story of Art Geek Zoo, The Way of Sound. I thought, I'm going to talk about a crush or a relationship Pick had in high school. And I'll make it about the Pick's decision, well, which is the title of the story, Metal or the Girl, essentially. Yeah. And then, so why would that need to be a decision? So a lot of people would say, why not Metal and the Girl? And how does that work? So that led to how do you get from point A to point B was a lot of questions that I just filled out in an outline. And
awesome. You did this before you started drawing?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
And that helped me quite a bit. But then I didn't know if I was generating too many ideas that would fit. So then I started thumbnailing and seeing if this story with these events in it, will it fit? And what do I have time for too? Because part of it too is I edited as I went along, realizing that I was taking too long on some pages and I was redrawing. And so I had this, so other quirks and habits you'll stare at, in the mirror as you're trying to do this in 24 hours.
Yeah.
For me, it was the whole zoom in too much and start noodling with the artwork and using undo way too much.
Oh, you did this all digitally.
This was all digital on my Modbook. which it will be again.
Cool. So this was illustrated in Photoshop then?
On in Sketchbook Pro.
Oh, wow.
Yep. The word balloons are actually done in Illustrator because that isn't something I wanted to try to do differently. And I have a process that I like a lot that works really quick for me.
Okay.
So I just would, I drop the PNG into an Illustrator layout that was of the right size and then go through my normal word balloons, export again as a PNG. And I say, I love PNG as a format, just by the way.
Yeah, why do you like that better than GIF?
For no other reason, other because of the PNG was born out of that whole controversy surrounding the GIF format in the 90s. Who was it? Unisys or something. They owned a patent to the GIF format. Mm-hmm. And then they decided to start enforcing it. And everyone was using it quite a bit because it's an efficient indexed raster format. So indexed means you're not using all the colors. You're using a very small set of colors, and raster meaning it's pixels. So you could do large artwork depending on the way the information in the artwork, you could get some pretty small files. And so it was very popular and whatever, but a lot of people were frustrated, including me, and PNG was born out of it. And what's cool is it's kind of a super format because it does that job and it does JPEG's job. Doesn't do JPEG's job as good as JPEG though, but it allows for alpha transparencies and stuff. Anyway, I highly recommend reading the entire Wikipedia page on PNG.
Awesome.
And you'll experience.
There's Rob's format nerd moment of the week.
What's it like to love a format?
So, going back to this, I like this idea of if you're stuck, you know, it's like some people may argue with you that, hey, this project is about improvising. It's about improvising a story by giving yourself only an hour to do each page.
Mm.
I don't want to get into a purist versus not purist debate because anything can be anything to anybody, right? The whole thing is it's inclusive. Everybody can participate in their own way. You know, even your pages are a different format than what was originally conceived of for 24-hour comic day. Yeah. So I like this idea of either starting out with an outline of let's prioritize our points. Here's the big idea. Here's some smaller ideas. And let's connect these smaller ideas to support the big idea with questions. Why? How? You know? Mm-hmm. It's not just what. This is a way of thinking about it. Is what is the series of events? But the what comes out of figuring out what the why and the how are. And when I say how, I mean, I think about this is language that I picked up through teaching work is you don't ask yes or no questions to your students, right? Because that's just because it's yes, sure, why not? You say, how does this change the way we feel about it? Now I'm asking for elaboration. Now I'm asking for their thinking process. Why did you make this such and such and not that? Now I'm going to ask them to justify their decisions on the page, right? Mm-hmm. Requires more sophisticated thinking to ask how and why rather than what. Or which panel is bigger, that one? You know, I haven't really asked them to do any kind of like real sophisticated judgment there, except to evaluate what they see in front of them, right?
Right.
So this connective tissue of the what is the how and the why. Now that is abstract. I think I get the abstract award this time. That probably made sense to two people.
I think it makes a lot of sense, especially as you think about composing a story, because those are your building blocks. And it's just that what fills in what the building block is made of is, well, it's your characters and the setting and their actions and that exemplify the how things are occurring and why.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas
I noticed that you stopped toning the pages later on too, as we're getting to the end of the story. There's no gray tones.
Yeah, I was in a pickle with time and I wanted to stay true to having I cheated with the last page. I just had them come back together. Sorry for spoiling it. Yeah, there was a lot of trade-offs. And sure, someone could say that this doesn't exemplify whatever objective version of the challenge. Fair enough. But for me, I did the 24 pages that that I wanted to do that finished the story. So I got from point A to point B.
Yeah, that's the big idea. You composed the story and you did the drawings to tell the story. So... So, I mean, what was the big takeaway from doing it the first time? There must have been something to make you want to do it again, unless you're just bullheaded and just, you know, you like to take on challenges just to see how far you can go before you crack.
Let's see. Some of it is, I don't know, just, practicing being uncomfortable, because it's an exercise that I find helpful to be able to create the things I think of creating and know that I'm going to finish this, and I can draw upon those experiences when I'm uncomfortable. They're often fresh ideas and examples that because I was forced to adapt and to come up with these, and I bring these adaptations back to other projects. So it's sort of speculative and research and experimental and seeing what comes. And it happens to be one of those kinds of experiments that's not just there's definitely a lot of discomfort involved. So,
you know, and I think that's probably like the biggest idea of all about a project like 24-hour comic day is it's not about the rules of engagement. It's about, like you said, it's about getting from point A to point B in a very strict time frame and then discovering survival techniques to get you through that. Mm-hmm. And then which it serves a lot of purposes, right? It like boosts your morale later on when you're working on other projects and you're like, oh god, you know, that creeping feeling comes in of like, I'm a hack, I'm no good, I don't know what I'm doing, dude, you did that. But then also it's going to, like, one of the things that Scott McCloud said about 24-hour comic day is that as the inventor of the thing, as he said, you'll never think about your storytelling the same way again. And I always wondered what that meant. Like, I'm gonna, like, suddenly, it's like when you start talking about abstract concepts like nirvana, enlightenment, and things like that, where it's like you think, what's that?
And having kids,
yeah, you'll see colors in a totally new way. And as a guy who doesn't have children, who has not achieved the blissful state of nirvana, and you know, all these things sound really strange to me, like, really, it's gonna change that much. And part of me gets like into that Star Trek 5 Captain Kirk, like, I need my pain, don't push me in that direction, you know, my pain defines who I am, and I don't want to change like that. But then again, I do begin to understand this idea of you'll never look at it the same way again, because now you have developed new appendages to help you survive in that dangerous environment that you can call upon for when you're in less dangerous environments, when you're just, you know, doing the day-to-day slog, right?
Exactly.
Like, I actually have my Boulder and Fleet one pulled up that I can try to upload while we talk.
Oh, excellent.
So how do I... Oh, I just got to make a new pod. Is that it?
Yes. There you go.
And new share. Here we go. Share document. We'll see if this is too big.
It's something...
Oh, we're going to browse.
Our comic day is just a... I mean, it's some structure, something to go about that process. That there's no reason why you can't do that on any project, any day. But for some reason, if it depends on you and your learning style, and you know, it's like, well, why do people do the hard stuff sometimes? You know, why would someone train for a marathon? Why would someone train to I don't know, get a black belt? Or why would you, why would you
climb a mountain?
Yeah, why'd you climb a mountain? Or, like, or some client pro, it's some client work. I mean, sometimes you could, you know, it's like, okay, here, finish this website, finish this, drawing, the story or whatever in like a weekend, right? Friday to Monday or whatever.
Yeah.
Why would you take that on? It's, sometimes I suppose it would be for the, for trade because you need to, other times it's just to get better at what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, well, we're talking about a bit of a philosophical mindset now, this idea of always being afraid. You know, this is something I take very seriously. It's like, if I'm not terrified of what I'm doing, I don't feel like I'm doing something really all that valuable to me. Right. And that sounds like dumb and X Games and all like super challenging. Like, you got to push yourself and get in there. Like, I'm sound like some kind of coach or something, you know, and I don't want to be that guy, but no, I think about how, you know, it's a great litmus test for knowing if I'm doing something I'm going to enjoy doing or I'm going to feel satisfied with later on is putting myself in a situation where I don't know if I'm going to make it through this thing. If I walked into every project feeling like I got this, then it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of value to be achieved through doing it other than just doing the thing itself. I like there to be more layers to the value, personally, if that makes any sense.
Totally does. That's why I will add a couple of extra curveballs to 24-hour comic day, because no matter what, I'll get those experiences out of it.
Yeah. So I'll tell you one of the big takeaways from doing this Boulder and Fleet thing, which again is not a 24-hour comic, but was a comic done under severe time limitations. I remember, and I documented this in the Thunder Punch Daily Show back when I was doing this story. I remember I started out with one theme that I was going to, one method of attack at my argument. And I realized quickly that there's no way I can do that in 8 pages. I got like halfway through the story. I was like, there's no room to really express this idea clearly with the space allotted. And I had it sketched out that at the end of the story. So like, okay, I'm looking at the pages right now. So what happens is Boulder and Fleet, these two adventurers, come into this town. It's run by this guy who everybody just calls His Eminence. He's like this lizard guy with spiky armor. And there's like one rule in the town is that unless you conform to their standard of quality and excellence, you can't live here. You cannot be part of our community unless you look. And really what this comes out of, it was the theme was, I overheard some cartoonists talking about, if you aren't classically trained as an illustrator, you can't call yourself a cartoonist. Literally, you can't. You know, like if you're self-taught or if you have a crude style, that precludes you from being a cartoonist forever, you know. And their argument was in favor of, well, we want the word cartoonist to have some sort of value. I'm like, dude, you are so missing the point. But anyway, so that was the inspiration for this bad guy. And so Boulder and Fleet say that you know, we can't work for you because, you know, we don't like the way you operate. Oh, it was because yeah, here we go. If we go to this
so
page
much more now with that explanation, Jersey.
What's that?
I hate your bad guy so much more now. With that explanation. Excuse me. Please continue.
Well, like I said, I tried to be very oblique about what I was referring to in this. Somebody actually called me out and said, is this about your teaching work? About you not being like a classically trained teacher and this is you defending your position? And I was like, oh gosh, no. This isn't about me defending myself. This is me defending people who work in stick figure, who are great storytellers, who other people mock for not being good illustrators, you know. That really, that's a way to push my buttons fast. But anyway, so yeah, when the bad guy meets Boulder and Fleet, he's like, oh, Boulder, you look like a big, strong bear. You look like somebody who meets our standards of excellence. You should join our organization. But then Fleet, the little bird, is like, okay, well, you know, we charge by the hour and whatever. And he laughs at her and says, no, we meant your big friend, not you silly little thing, right? So now I'm using size as my metaphor. Big equals good, small equals like, well, he doesn't see the value in what she is, right? And so when Boulder says, well, no, I'm not, we don't work with anybody, we're a team, you don't get me without getting her. There's more, and he says, you know, there's more to this job than size, right? There's more to this job than what is apparently quality. And the bad guy says, don't tell me what a real pro is and is not, you know, because they're the ones who are going to get really defensive about it. So they start fighting. And it was at this point that I realized I don't have the room to really express this guy's core philosophy. I was going to express the theme through an argument during the fight, because that's another thing that I get really passionate about, is I like that comics can actually have dialogue during an action sequence. I know that's unrealistic, but so is rendering people in lines. So I didn't have the room. And I had it in my notes that eventually Fleet was going to be the one to deal the killing blow. Fleet was going to hit him in the face, and then that inspires all of the people in town to go and beat him up. And all the little animals, all the little stuffed animal-looking creatures are the ones who take down the big bully, right? Which is a cute idea. It makes us happy. Ewoks, right? It's an old idea. Actually what it was I don't think I had it in my notes that Fleet was the one who did that. I think it was just that they get inspired by the fight to get involved. And then when I realized I didn't have a way to express my theme, I realized that the theme was there all along. It was there with the animals attacking at the end. And let's just have Fleet lead the charge. Fleet leads the charge and inspires all the little guys that, yeah, we may be smaller. We may not conform to this guy's standard of quality, but we're valuable too. And they run the guy out of town at the end. There, I spoiled the story. It's an 8-page story. How can you spoil an 8-page story? But anyway, so the point, here's my takeaway. My takeaway is that I learned to trust myself as an author a little bit more, and that things I put down on the page intuitively may come out to become more important, may rise to the surface to be more important later on as I'm going through the spade work and grunt work of connecting all of the pieces. So if I were to do a 24-hour comic, I'd start with my argument and start instinctively and, I'm trying to think of, like, not subconsciously, that's what I'm trying to say, subconsciously start throwing stuff on the page, trusting that there's good stuff in there someplace, and I'll figure it out as I go.
That's probably a pretty darn strong approach. What's interesting is obviously that's very individual, and I don't mean to say I'm judging your approach, but like I was already thinking about some of the strength in doing this, and over a longer period of time, that's one of the reasons it's not just what you get directly out of 24-hour comic day. It's what you've squeezed out to not include to then appreciate. And I think that part of what helps me write better stories, and why, I mean, I think I had fun with writing Metal or the Girl, but what I ended up learning is weaving together those in-between moments. It helps me to reflect on it a little bit, and or to just actually not even like think about it deliberately, but just to now appreciate the thing I just made and like play it back and sort of flip through the pages and all of a sudden realize intuitively the next thing that should occur instead of just operating on a prescribed map. Yeah. And yeah. Whereas during 24-hour comic day, because of the approach I chose, I had a fairly prescribed map that I just needed to then finish. I can see how it would be really helpful to then realize the themes and the subtle things that were in your creation the whole time, just because of you were creating it.
Right. Yeah. And I'll tell you, you've probably been here too. That's the moment where you're like this, where you're doing the double-fisted shaking your hands over your shoulders, like, oh my gosh, I did it. I am so good. I feel like $1 million. I'm going to walk down the street with my chest out, you know? Those are really, really satisfying moments, which is weird, right? Because it's like, it's the part that happened intuitively. You're getting excited about your intuition over getting excited about what you did deliberately. Like when I do something deliberately, somehow it doesn't feel as satisfying as when I do it kind of like from the hip and naturally. I guess like comes out of that notion of talent. We like to think about, a lot of people like to think about things as being talent, and I always get a little bristly whenever I hear that word. I like to just say,
absolute. Is talent for you something that's in your control or it's out of your control? I'm just wondering.
I think talent is absolutely in your control. I define talent as interest. I don't think that I had a brain specialist, like somebody who actually like puts things on people's heads and then studies like the parts of the brain that light up when they eat hot dogs. But there's probably some kinds of dispositions that are genetically there, right? Like physically, I am not built to play basketball at a professional level. Yeah, I'm 6 foot one, but you know, I don't have the built-in athleticism. I could probably push myself to a point where I could get close to it, or maybe even if I really, really, really wanted to, really work hard, maybe get to. But you know, there's certain levels that I can't reach physically, right? So okay, I'll accept that. But when it comes to like a knack for something, I think a lot of it has to do with interest. So when people say, oh, you're really talented, I'm like, no, I'm not at all. I'm just really, really interested. I just care about comics more than anything. When I was in high school and I'd get in a fight with my girlfriend when we were on a date, she'd say, I'm going home. I'd say, okay, I'm going to go home and draw comics. And that's literally what I did, is I would just go home and I would happily just, la, la, la. I don't care what she says, you know? I remember like thinking at one time I was working on a comic. I was like, I think I'm supposed to be crying right now. Because like she yelled at me about something, but you know, I didn't care because I cared about comics more. So that's why I got any good at this thing. You know, it's not because, you know, I got some kind of gift, some kind of genetic gift given to me by some outside force. I resent that idea, actually, this idea of an outside force having anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. The only outside forces were people in my life who pushed me in a direction or gave me any kind of encouragement. That's the outside force, not like some kind of magical Obi-Wan Kenobi stuff that can make me move rocks. What?
No, that's funny.
Did I just paint myself into the atheist corner and now a whole bunch of people could be mad at me? I'm not an atheist, everybody.
No.
I'm not in anything.
I wasn't presuming that. I just was I was laughing as far as the because I both think that I agree with what you said. It's some talent is something you can choose to grow. And I think interest is a really I'm not going to say interesting way to put it. It is a, I like how that frames it up because you can be focused on this and, grow your own talent. Then the force aspect was, I like the old aspect. Even though I feel that way, I like the old force definition for the record.
Oh, like the old, like the original trilogy force definition.
Yes.
What always bothered me about it, I mean, there's a lot of things that I don't want to talk Star Wars too much because everybody's tired of Star Wars. But one of the things that always bothered me about that series was the fact that some people have a predisposition for it and some don't. Like, oh, well, Leia's your sister, so of course she can use it. And like the moment she finds out that she's his sister, she's like, oh, I can feel his presence. What? And Han Solo can never be a Jedi. That sucks. You don't have the right DNA, kid. Oh, that's awful. That's so anti-Western. And then like this whole like, here, put this helmet on Luke and you can't see anything. Well, trust your feelings. Just trust. Listen to me. I know what you need to do here. And you just got to let go of your thinking mind and then you'll do the things right. And then as soon as he lets go of his mind, whack him, whack him, whack him with the lightsaber. He does it perfectly. This whole idea of like letting go of your intellect and just trusting your feelings and listen to the old man because he knows. The Westerner in me goes, ooh.
That's funny.
But you know what? People argue that, hey, Return of the Jedi, Luke is the one who breaks the rules. Luke is the one who doesn't do what Yoda told him to, goes and faces Vader, finds it, makes things worse, but then he's the one who fixes it by through his own volition, his own path that he chooses. And I go, okay, I grant you. I like that. But the whole, like, dressing in the Eastern philosophy idea of relinquishing your identity to something else makes me shiver. Makes me wake up in the night sweating.
Wow. Yeah, you actually have, you've contemplated the meaning of that far more than I have, which I do respect. For some entertainment, I really have, but to me, it's just like a laser sword is sweet. And I still think, and I'm not purely everything is robotically analytical. I love to let go of that aspect. And, which is one reason why I choose to do art challenges from time to time is to, I'm forced to not depend on that aspect of my creative process. So I need
good point.
to see, well, what have I learned? What is natural now? Because I'm continually, by creating on an ongoing basis, I keep affecting what I can do. And I can ignore that a little bit if I'm only staying in that rational, Robert McKee's story, this house is how you architect, you know, things, you know, positive to negative, which is neat and super helpful. But there is an aspect of that that's pretty dispassionate. And I find
I totally agree that is like probably the number one value of an art challenge is getting lost in the thing and just using the desperation of the deadline to see you through rather than having to stop and coldly wonder about each step of the game, right? And then the learning that you do only happens after the fact, right? It comes upon reflection. If I wasn't doing Thunder Punch Daily at the time I did that Boulder and Fleet comic, I probably would not have captured those thoughts and the takeaways that I got out of that. Maybe I would intuitively, but I wouldn't be able to articulate it as easily. But doing Thunder Punch Daily while I was doing the comic forced me to say, okay, at the end of each day where I did something, was there anything that I got out of this? What's going on in my head right now? Let's capture a few thoughts and see if it's worth repeating. Most of the thoughts as I was doing it was, oh my God, I'm never going to finish. That was 90% of the content that was coming out of my head. But
did you have the arrogant thing at first where you're like, I'm so going to do this. This is, I can't wait. Like when you begin and then did you become daunted? I'm just wondering, was there...
Yeah. Here's okay, going to that, I'm going to chart my morale as I tell this anecdote with my, you know, holding my hand in the air for those who are listening to the audio and not watching the video. I started out with the kind of naive optimism of, this is going to be really hard, but I think I can do it, you know? Like that Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, like, let's put on a show in the backyard kind of idea. We can do it. And then I got the initial character designs done and like the first page drawn, and I drew the first page in like an hour or so, and then arrogance kicked in. And then I was like, oh man, look at this kid. I am going to kick the crap out of this comic, and I'm going to, you know, everybody's going to shower me with flowers. I'm going to get a ticker tape parade after this thing. Page three, I'm like, oh my God, what have I done? What have I done? I announced this to the public. I made a proclamation. This is going to be done. And here it is. Here's the evil jersey sitting across the table from me going, you're a hack, you're a fool, you're a faker, and everybody's going to know now because you're going to have to put this comic online because you said you would, and they're going to see how bad it is. No.
Oh boy.
That's page three. And then like, yeah, but when I got to page six or seven, I was back up. I was riding a little higher again. Mm-hmm. And then it started turning into like a, whew, I made it. Oh, I'm pretty good at this thing, huh? I'm pretty good at this thing. Now I can't wait to finish it. And I finished a day early because I was just so eager to get it done. I put aside work to actually finish it because I was so excited about it.
Funny.
So yeah. Is that like mirror at all your process?
It does. Yeah. And I know that I'm going to get my own butt kicked. And even though I know it, I'm like, I still go in and like, yeah, I can't wait. This is going to be great. I'm excited. I'm going to do, it's so much discovery. I have no idea what I'm going to even make. And then, you know, and then obviously once I sort of architect it and think, look at this. Now it's like I've set up my ramps on either side of the buses. I just got to rev my motorcycle and jump these things. No biggie.
Right. Yeah.
But then, you know, then I realized, boy, that ramp looks kind of shaky. Oh, I'm almost out of gas. Oh, and whatever. And yeah. Then I obviously I fight a lot of doubts and stuff along the way too.
So yeah. It's sort of like, here's another way of looking at it is it's a way to encapsulate the entire process of doing a long form comic in one day. You know, it's like they talk about like the five stages of grief or whatever. Sure. You know, it's like, and then finally acceptance. It's like it's taking all of that and making you go through it all in one day. And so you get a life experience in a day.
Exactly.
For those of you who have trouble making time for life experiences. 24-hour comic.
Exactly. It's a little boot camp, a vacation away from your normal process, and you get to get the ride that roller coaster of I'm awesome to my God, what have I done? And on back again.
I think it's cool though that you could separate yourself from that and reflect on it, and because I bet that makes it easier to get through those darker times, like when in the long form projects.
Yeah, it's
because you're more aware that this is a cycle and this is something you're eventually going to come out of, right? So,
yeah, it puts me into an observer seat, not just.
Yeah, we talked about that last week or last episode.
Yep, exactly, and this, so it totally relates. Let's see here. Just to mention, whatever. I'll put a link to this online. I don't have to tell the story because you had all sorts of interesting observations about Boulder and Fleet by the page and whatnot. And yeah, for this, it just really I didn't have that. I mean, it's really this blur of
it's a longer story completed in a shorter time. So yeah.
Yeah, with less of those. I gained a huge appreciation by doing it for pacing and knowing when I need to go, or trying to discover when I need to go quieter or present something and then try to build up a surprise, because I really didn't have a chance to do that in the way that I wanted to in that whole architecture of the story. So looking back at it, I can think about, well, how do I feel about it? And where did I, you know, what kind of, how do I feel about the result as far as the story, the art, the.
I have a weird question for you. And I don't know if I've ever asked this of you before. It's rare that I get to talk to cartoonists who are also musicians. Mm. I think there's a lot of crossover between making music and making comics. At least I personally, I suspect it. I mean, as somebody who doesn't make music, I can only suspect, but my little brother's a musician. You met him. You met Elliot. Mm-hmm. He and I have had long, extended conversations, and I wish I could get him to be on shows with me because he's like probably three times as interesting as I am. But he just, and that's probably why he's a lot more shy about getting behind the mic, because he realizes that words have power. I'm a little bit more callous and cavalier about it. But I wonder if when you're writing like this, how much of this you feel in terms of kind of like when you're writing music, there's a pace to it, right? And the pace can change depending on the emotion you're trying to evoke. Like I think of like Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, and that piece of music tells a story, right? Like there's parts that are really big and flamboyant, but then it'll go back to like the ballad part where it swells and falls, and then it goes to the Russians marching across the snow, you know, and has a little bit more of this kind of like peppy, like we're coming feel, and then all of a sudden it goes to that swell again to like the more ballad type part of it, and then it kicks over like to the big explosive part, and it'll even do slow builds to like, you know, there's a part where like the 1812 bit that will be played just on a couple flutes very softly, and then the horns come in, and then the bigger brass comes in, and it builds and builds and builds, and then the cannons start firing off. Do you, when you're pacing a story like this, do you use that kind of like whatever organ is triggered by music like that to feel out the pacing of your story? Does it feel the same way?
It does, but it's one of those things where you don't, it's good news, bad news. You don't have to listen to that voice. So you may gain an appreciation for like for instance, a guitarist could be soloing for too long, or, anyone in the band can be, sort of just not on the same page as far as representing the different elements of the story, different members of the band, or, some songs are could get their point across a lot shorter or whatnot. So you have this pattern of how you're managing the information you're sharing in either case. It's with music, you're sharing sound, and the rhythm is part of the information. The tone, the techniques you use, the instrumentation, all that is, you could also, all the different art practices have their instruments, and then the information that you use use instruments to bring about. And then there's the pattern of how you're doing it, which is like that pacing and stuff. And I think that's that a lot of it does apply, because of those three different aspects. And I think one of the biggest aspects that's super applicable is that rhythm and pacing.
Let me ask you this. I'm going to keep on this analogy for a second. And anyway, everybody who's listening, we're still talking in an analogy of music. You said sometimes the guitarist can go on a solo too long.
Right.
What makes somebody go on a solo too long? Is it a sense of, this is awesome, I'm focused on this thing I'm doing, I just don't want to stop? Is it like a failure to understand the big picture of where the thing is going? Is that what it is? Or is it something else?
Well, I'm going to say this totally relates to the beginning part of the conversation. It's, well, why is that person doing that creative act? And then the people that are choosing to be there to be part of it and listen to it or read it or whatever, or in the case of, yeah, music, they're listening. And those could be either well met, like the guitarist is trying to really crank up and affect emotion by changing the pace, changing the pattern, and try to go from then contrast. I guess that's the other big thing with the different art techniques. I mean, you get their pacing through the contrast and rhythm. Now, if they are in tune and sort of part of why the guitarist is doing the solo, it's to just put this. It's to go to the overloading point of emotion to then let it go. But then if the pattern never changes and it stays there, that people get numb. And so is that person doing, I don't know why the person would be doing it. So some guitarists, yeah, how many guitarists does it take to screw in a light bulb?
is this a joke? Yeah. Is this a real thing?
Yeah. I'm just, how many?
I don't know.
One to do it and five to say they could have done a better job.
Okay. little musical humor for you folks out there. I think that same thing could apply to cartoonists.
Sure.
But yeah, I'm just trying to get a sense of when I'm feeling out the rhythm of a story, I think about that a lot. Like everything you said about a solo, it's like you're trying to affect emotion. You're trying to say, this is the awesome part. This is the part where I'm really going to get you. You know, we're all going to raise our hands and scream. We're on the crest of the roller coaster. But eventually you have to go down and you have to calm down a second. And part of the way I manage that personally is I think about what's the big picture. I try to keep one eye on zoomed in on what the moment is. But then the other eye is like always focused on where am I ultimately going with this whole thing? And maybe my example isn't quite applicable to everybody because I'm talking about a lot of the books I write are ensemble books, like a big cast, 12 or more characters. So I have a lot of places to go. I have a lot of places visually and tonal wise to zip around, to change the tone, change the pacing. But yeah, if it's like as a guy who writes a lot of action adventure stories for kids, if it was page after page of explosions, the first three explosions, yeah, the kids are going to be going, yeah. But page six, it's like, oh, there's another one. You know, you got to have that. You got to zoom in and out of that of a visual variety as well as like a pacing variety. Pacing in terms of density of word balloons. I'm looking at your 24-hour comic. There's a lot of dialogue in this thing, man.
I know.
But not all the time. I mean, here's the study hall scene I'm looking at. You know, that seems a little bit more of a slower pace.
Oh, yeah.
But then... Yeah, later on, like it gets more verbally dense. Oh, but look at this action sequence, not as verbally dense, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a pacing thing. It's like the rhythm of density of word, density of image, also density of panels on the page, 12 panels on a page versus 3 panels on a page versus 1 panel on a page, that kind of thing. And then there's the density of how many word balloons per panel. How much detail is in each panel, right? Is it a crowd scene in every panel? So you have a lot of options of what to switch from, not just like plot element, not just like, oh, well, let's go look at this character. But you also have the option to say like, well, can I zoom out? Can I zoom out really far back to get like a more kind of tranquil transitional moment? I mean, if you read my graphic novel, The Front, I do that a lot. That's like almost, I use it almost as a crutch, is if I have to change scenes, I start with 3/4 down shot, 100 feet away to say, this is where the characters are. It's both a a staging element to say, okay, here's where all my characters are, so you have a sense of the location. But it's also a way to take a breath before diving into the next act, or what do they call it? What is that thing they call it when they switch it in music, when they switch to the middle eight or whatever in like a pop song?
Songs have different structures, so it could be, you know, A B C, you know, so A would be your verse chorus bridge, you know, intro outro, whatever. It's just your structure,
right? Yeah.
So you had a but then with your structure you have a way to connect the parts. And so music, a lot of times you'll hear drum fills, and the drums playing a role of helping you follow along on the rhythm. And when all of a sudden, and then, you know, yeah, kind of thing. Those sort of change ups, they know that, well, this is it's an exciting, and then different thing, excite, or take a step back, like rest, yes, you know, and it's a way to do exactly what you were saying with those scene changes.
Yeah, it's like taking a break, taking a rest, taking a breath before. I mean, it's the same thing with public speaking too, right? Like I did my Ignite talk, the Comics Are Great one. I did it in January. Is that when I did the one in Ann Arbor? I think. I did it in Ann Arbor for Ann Arbor Ignite, and then I did it again a few months ago, the same talk for Ignite Great Lakes. And the second time I did it, I had the same amount of speed, but I had trained myself enough in that talk to where I knew how to pace it out better and take a few little, stop and take a breath, and change the rhythm of my language so that I could build up something where I'm really getting excited, and then I can slow down a little bit and say, well, you know, this is a neat part. And then I'm going to get really excited again. And it was a way, this comes out of teaching too. It's a way to keep people's attention, right? If I'm just constantly going at a million miles an hour for 5 minutes, I'm going to lose them because it becomes noise after a while. We can only hold our attention on things for so long. And so you have to pace it out. You have to back off, slow down, and get fast again. This goes for music. This goes for comics. This goes for any kind of storytelling, right?
I agree. And actually, it ties back to the guitar solo thing. So if you are sharing this information with the point of keeping people following along versus just saying, boy, do I love to talk, right? That would be the equivalent of the self-indulgent guitar solo.
Okay. That's good. I didn't expect us to talk so much about pacing today. This was cool. So like using the speech analogy a little bit more, just a little bit, is like if I were to go and tell that story again where I was charting my morale on, like a line that I'm moving with my hand, it'd be like, okay, so there I was, and I was in this place, and I thought this thing was going to happen. But then it got really cool because, and listen to the pacing of my voice when I do this, but then it got really cool because this guy who I really, really like came up and said, hey, you want to do a thing? And I said, yeah, I really want to do the thing. But then we turned the corner, and then I saw somebody who I really, I just really don't like this person. And I thought, this is going to suck. But then I got a little closer, and I realized that person wasn't who I thought it was, and it got really cool, and I got really excited because it was all these people that I really wanted to talk to. And then all of a sudden, you know what they talked about? They talked about pooping their own pants, and that is not something I want to talk about with people. So I was like, oh God, this sucks after all. So I guess the thing I learned today is that even cool people can talk about dumb stuff every once in a while. The end. There's a story, and that was paced, right?
It was.
I don't know if I did it well, but...
No, and that's there you go. Like you mentioned, the scene changes being a crutch and whatever. I think that you'll have your own styles with how you connect those different parts and how you so you shift gears and to not make that too abrupt or whatever. And that's where you get different styles, and that's cool. Like a lot of metal is about that shift in emotion from the change from peace to intense. Something, right? And you can't have that switch up if everything is constantly intense all the time. And chances are, yeah, a song that is that way is brief. Like your Ignite talk. Your Ignite talk is kind of like a speed metal of speeches.
uh, I have never had anything that I've done compared to something cool like that before. That was pretty, I'm going to hang on to that analogy because I feel like it legitimizes what I do.
It stands on its own, but it's,
yeah. The sad part is that that's the part that everybody mentions about it. It's like, it's not like, oh, you made your points really well. Or like, oh, I really walked away feeling like I want to read comics now. Everybody's always like, that was fast. Oh, wow. I mean, when I did the talk at Ignite Great Lakes, that's what she said when I walked off the stage. It's like, oh, wow, the next presenter is going to have to learn to talk faster. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I'm glad that I demonstrated some kind of skill that I can talk really fast. But I was really hoping you guys would walk out going like, oh, man, I got to read a comic tomorrow, you know. But, oh, well.
It's like a great, well, it's like a really fast, great guitar solo. I mean, people notice that, wow, you know, Jersey can play. That's awesome.
That's true. Like when you listen to an Eddie Van Halen solo, nobody ever comments on, oh, this is inspired by classical music theory of such and such. It's like, look at how fast he could do that finger tapping, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that speech is your eruption.
All right, enough about my damn speech. Are we wrapping this up? Are we coming in? Is there any closing thoughts on this? Anything that we want to, you know, come around full circle? And
I think there's a strong connection as far as it's audience connection is the connection, the connecting thought as far as whether you're thinking about what you're sharing online, your public persona, or however connected and related that is to your private self and how you choose to interact, I think there's a similar sort of a choice you have when you're creating is with your pacing and engaging your audience and how are you connecting with them. And they're all related creative acts.
Good point. You know, it's like pacing yourself in your social media stream so you're not just like pumping 40 tweets like in a row and then not talking anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, pacing it out. Pace it out and like try to build the narrative with what you're doing. And when I say narrative, it's not the data that's in the messages that you share, but a narrative in terms of what do all of these things amount to? What does all this stuff collectively say? And have I structured them in a way? No, I'm not talking about don't improvise, because that was also a theme today, wasn't it? Was improvisation is a great way to learn something about yourself and also have fun with this stuff. This isn't all deliberate Sun Tzu Art of War kind of strategizing, right? It doesn't always have to be that way. So yeah, play with it too, but ultimately it's about communicating an idea about a larger message about who you are deliberately and genuinely, whether it's constructed or not, whether it's constructed through a narrative, whether it's constructed through social media, and then there should be some kind of a general pace to it all so as to not bore the audience or desensitize them to something. That's pretty good, Rob.
Hey, I you brought it home. It rocks.
With the guitar solo.
Sweet solo. Thank you.
Good night. Good night, Cleveland. Okay. Well, you know, we should say that, you know what this the story building analogy was inspired by was I was getting ready with my notes and my presentations for 30 classes in 30 days. This is part of the Comics Fundamentals series that I teach. And I'm bringing it to Lean Into Art. 30 classes in 30 days can be found at leanintoart.com. Yes?
That's right. Yeah, just check out leanintoart.com, and it's a link right at the top. 30 classes in 30 days. You can still register. It works out if at the gold level. I mean, it's only $10 a class. And that's kind of wild. I mean, it's something that you would go to your art center locally, or in our case, we're online. And some of our classes will be meeting in an Adobe Connect, like this podcast is. And the others will be, downloadable as a podcast and video and all sorts of stuff. And lots of cool topics from some specific things as far as like Jersey. You're also doing lettering, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. That's a topic that I'm very passionate about. Is the way sound works in a soundless visual medium. Mm. And so I'm going to be teaching a class on how I letter in Adobe Illustrator. This is my technique culled together from a lot of other places where I learned how other people do it. But this is like my strategy for lettering on a comics page. But also, to a larger point, something that I'm much more interested in than the actual how is the why. Why do you make this sound look this way and not that way? How do you design a good sound effect? And hey, sound effects are more than just bam pow in the Batman TV show. Sound effects are the texture of your story in terms of audio, but it's also a aesthetic component. You put sound in there in a very deliberate and certain way so that it is aesthetically harmonious with the overall piece. Mm-hmm. And then there's another layer to it as well, is that how does color contribute to the quality of the sound? Is throwing a rock through the air... Let's figure that out. First, we got to decide how we spell it. Oh, it's okay. I'm going to do whoosh. All right. That kind of sounds like a rock flying through the air. Whoosh. W-H-O-O-S-H-H, exclamation point. And there's I have certain theories about like consonant and vowel combinations. More consonants mean this, more vowels mean that. But then, okay, let's design the letters so they evoke the quality of that air, the air passing by the rock. Right. What kind of lines would you use? Would you use a scraggly line or a smooth line? Well, it depends on the kind of sound. Like a rock falling into a pond is going to have a certain kind of line quality, whereas a rock flying through the air has a different line quality. A big metal ball falling in the middle of concrete sounds one way, but punching a big slab of meat with your fist sounds another way, right? So this all can be communicated through line. Then the next layer is, what color are you going to use? What color contributes to the quality of the sound? Or if it's too, you also have to consider, how does that color interact with the other colors on the page? If it's a nighttime scene and like, oh, this color, the sound would have a deep purple kind of quality to it. Ooh, now it kind of losing it in the background because it's a night scene. Well, I got to punch it up a little bit to make it more aesthetically harmonious, make it pop just the right amount. So there's a lot of things to consider when designing a sound effect if you really care about how all this works together in comics. And I love getting nerdy and talking about it forever and ever. I think it's slated for what, an hour and a half?
Hour. So I'd have to pull up the calendar, which the calendar is all available to know when the classes occur. It's on the same page, 30 classes in 30 days, a link at the top of Lean Into Art, which, you know, you describing all that thought process going into sound, it reminds me that, I mean, that class mentions Illustrator, which that'll be cool to teach those techniques as well. But it sounds super applicable no matter what you're using to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just going to be using Illustrator as my demonstration tool, but any vector program, you could do this in Flash. You could do this in, what other vector programs are out there that I don't know about?
Inkscape.
Okay. Open source. Never heard of that one.
Inkscape.
But yeah, there's tons of different ways to go at this thing. You could do this in Photoshop. You could do this on the page, right? You could do this with actual lines on paper. Thinking about this kind of stuff. I'm just going to be demonstrating it through one piece of digital software that I like to use. But what the bigger idea is for me is the theory behind it. And like I was saying, it's like an hour and a half class, something like that. But it probably will run longer because I tend to get carried away with that topic. Something that I did way back when I used to do the Art and Story podcast. I remember this is a couple years ago. We did an episode called The Big Sound Effect. And, it was born out of the fact that somebody challenged me online and said, you can't do a whole episode on sound effect design. You just can't. There's not enough there to talk about. And I was like, oh, really? And we wound up doing a 2-hour episode where I don't think I changed my pace. I think I was doing the endless guitar solo as I was proclaiming my love for sound effect design. And that guy came back to me and said, okay, apparently you can talk about sound effects for an hour or more.
It's super helpful. And honestly, I can't wait to see that class too, because I use sound quite a bit in my main comic. And let's see, and the other teachers that'll be there, Kevin Cross will be teaching color theory. Brandon Dayton will be teaching line work theory. Kim Holm will be doing a couple of really interesting sounding workshops. The dramaturgy of silliness.
an improvisation workshop. I've been present at this workshop before. It's super cool.
Awesome.
It's how to improvise a story. That's basically what it's about. It's about how to embrace silliness and embrace silly ideas that sound absurd at the outset, but using simple improvisational skills, you can combine any silly combination of elements into something that is a workable narrative.
Yeah, that sounds rather handy. So there's like this general theme of very useful creative classes, essentially, yes, and a whole darn month of them.
And yeah, the calendar is almost full. I'm just dropping in a few more items on there. But you can subscribe to the calendar on the 30 classes and 30 days page at leanintoart.com if you're curious about what you're getting and when. Calendar's not finished yet. And who knows? We might wind up doubling up some days, meaning that we might have more than we know what to do with, because Rob and I keep, every time we talk to each other, we're like, oh, we should do this. Oh, we should do this. And then Rob, because he's an idiot and likes to take on way more than he should, says, I'm going to do 9 classes.
Yeah, I did a podcast about it, too.
I know you did. Yeah. And as I was listening to it, I was just feeling my heart just got heavier and heavier. And I felt my shoulders slouch. He was like, you're really going to take all that on? What's wrong with you?
Well, it's I love to share the stuff that there you go. I experiment. I'm like the Consumer Reports of creative helpfulness, right? Except I'm the chair that's getting punched by the activating foot. It's like,
yeah,
you can sit in this chair about 5,000 times and it'll fall apart.
Is it difficult? Is it probably not a good idea? Let's do it.
Yeah,
Rob's credo. Which more of us should actually probably take on. I think the world would be a much happier and more exciting place to live in if more people took on that credo.
Yeah, as long as they're not involved in the hard sciences and space travel.
That's what the Apollo program was to the T. The entire Apollo program was, hey, in 10 years, let's take this technology that's not even proven, let's go to the moon and put people on it.
Make sure you fill in the gaps with some good hard science then, because they did sit on a lawn chair and strap bottle rockets to it.
No, they did not. Although you've seen that flying bedstead that almost killed Neil Armstrong. That was almost what it was.
Oh, funny.
The Apollo lunar excursion module mock-up that they used on Earth to test out how to fly that thing.
Oh no, I actually didn't see that. I'll have to check out that. There's probably a video of it or something, right?
YouTube. Yeah, and it's documented in that recreation of the entire thing from Earth to the Moon, that Tom Hanks vehicle. Oh, it's a great series.
Oh.
If you care at all about science and space travel and really, really great stories about the heroes, watch the Apollo 12 mission. It's the most fun, and it's totally... it's America. It's everything that's great about America. It's like, it's all these really hardworking people busting their backs to make this impossible thing happen. Crisis occurring when the rocket gets struck by lightning right after liftoff and the whole boards go out, and then like really smart people fixing it. And then these cocky, obnoxious Americans being goofballs about the whole mission and having fun with it. And, you know, Neil Armstrong gets off the ladder and he says, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Pete Conrad, when he gets off the ladder, he says, whoopee. Now that to me is America. That's like, we worked really, really hard. Let's have a good time with it, please. We don't have to be solemn about everything.
Awesome. I do need to see that. Yeah, because I do love that. And in some way, how you connected that to me or whatever. So that is the most ridiculous compliment I've ever heard. So, I'm happy to partake in that silliness though.
But anyway, so leanintoart.com, click the 30 classes and 30 days link. There's still time to sign up. And there's still a few gold seats left. So if you're interested, or if you know somebody who you think would be interested in this such a thing. And then there's the silver tier, which is like 100. Is that right? No, 170 is the silver tier.
And you still get all the classes. It's just you're not a part of the live aspect.
Yep. You just get recorded versions of the live aspect. So,
but we'll all be in the forum, and it's going to be a fun time.
Hey, we got to pat you on the back about that gallery that you built. We haven't talked about that since we did, since you built it.
Funny. Well, I let's do a little teaser of this episode and we'll cover it in more detail. How about next one? There is a, there's a cool, I'm proud of this feature because it sort of, it exemplifies how we want to celebrate our teachers and our students that are part of Lean Into Art. We have a shared gallery where, if you're a teacher or a student at Lean Into Art, send us some of your work each week and, we'll feature it there. And if you got some notes about it, we have a form that you can log in and submit stuff to. And, we show it in a, this gallery thing that I crafted up. It's just a cool slideshow you can pull up and sit back and have a sip of your coffee, take a break, see some neat work. Or you can sort of navigate through and see, and if you're curious about what the newest stuff is and, explore it. It's available at leanintoart.com. Look at the menu on the side of the page and it's called the Lean Into Art Gallery of Creative Works.
Super cool. Yeah. I mean, I conclude a lot of my, multi-week workshop series with a showing of the students' works where the parents are invited to come for snacks and we put the work up on the wall so that they can see what everybody made. And that's cool. But then I also have the students stand next to their work and explain why they did what they did. Why'd they make this panel big? Why'd they make this panel small? It's reflective activity. It allows them to reflect on what they've accomplished. It shows the parents that the students are now the experts, but it also helps educate the general public as well, and people who might be interested in taking the class, that this is what we do in this class. It's a way to show off what cool stuff is going to be happening here. So, yeah, I encourage everybody who signs up to participate in that. I'm going to be adding some things to it in the next day or so. So, and we're going to make a big spotlight out of it every Thursday, I think, wasn't it? Or was it every Wednesday?
It's Wednesday right now is the plan, but while it's a permanent thing, the stuff we do around the communication of it and how it's going to flow, right now we're saying Wednesday, but that can evolve.
Yeah. It can always change. So Anything else that we need to make noise about? Good luck on 24-hour comic day, Rob.
Thanks. I'll do my best to report on it during it, and I'll certainly share, some thoughts, afterward.
Okay, well, if you do wind up being able to capture some of the event itself, you know, being there, if you can pull yourself out of being there to show the rest of us what it's like to be there, where would you be putting that information?
Let's see. I think, make that call right now.
You don't have to. We can always put it in the show notes.
One of two URLs, and it'll be either robstenzinger.com or it'll be interactive-storyteller.com. Okay. One of those two for sure.
And Twitter too, right? Like you'll probably be like saying like, hey, I put a thing there.
That's definitely. Rob. So if there's a little mystery, like, well, where's Rob talking about this? And you're curious, check out twitter.com/Rob Stenzinger.
More people need to follow you there anyway. So, because you got to collect them all.
Cool. And then I will do a sweet guitar solo for you all.
Oh, are you going to do stuff like that where you're like, if I get to 10,000 followers, I'll record myself doing a guitar solo. I'll eat my weight in hamburgers.
Oh, no.
That's a great way to get people who are actually signed on to your, you know, your value to do something like that. Yeah. Give away an iPad.
No, I'm not doing that kind of thing. I may do it for the fun of it. But if it's incidentally crass or foolish, that's incidental. No, the guitar solo. No.
No, just no. No. No.
That was a joke, folks.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for downloading and listening. Show notes are at leanintoart.com. And until next time, I've been Jersey Drost of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I'm Rob Stenzinger of robstenzinger.com. Rob Stenzinger on the Twitter.
This is where I say, okay, bye. Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can follow us on Twitter by searching for username leanintoart, and you can email us at leanintoart@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and don't forget, lean with your legs, not your back.